Let's go to another phone here, by the way, and see if we can pick up some people who are waiting patiently. It's KLO. Who's this?
Phil Hoagland.
Well, hello, Bill. How are you?
Fine. Got a question. Yeah. Was there not way back a late-night lady personality by the name of Dottie Knight?
Yeah, yes. I think Mr. Klein told about her earlier, but I'm not familiar with it. Dottie Knight.
What was the question?
I missed that.
Dottie Knight, the nighttime air personality.
Well, now, Dottie was married.
Married to somebody on the staff.
And Bob knows.
Bob
knows the story on this.
Here he comes.
No, Alan knows. Alan's here. Ask Alan.
Here, Alan.
Yeah, Dottie Knight was Barney Groban's wife. Barney was the program director.
Okay.
And at the time that when I first came here in 1960, I worked the evening news from 6 to midnight. And Callie was on from like 6 to 9, and then she was on from 9 to midnight. And Barney used to hang around the station all the time. So, and he was a real character anyway. I mean, he'd be there, you know, 24 hours a day, slept in his office, and, you know, was always tinkering with things. And we used to go out. You had Ed Bowman on earlier today, who was out at Parkmore at the time. And we'd get off at midnight. She was off at midnight. I got off at midnight. And she and Barney and I would go over to Parkmore, where Ed was working, and eat, drink, and be merry, and, you know, mess with Bowman over there while he was on the air for an hour or two, you know, to wind down after the busy air shift. She was really a good air person, very, very professional.
As best I remember, she was out. What era? What years are we talking about?
60, 61.
60-61.
Right.
Okay. I don't know why I always got her and Phyllis Knight. That I guess it was just the name stuck together.
Probably, yeah.
Somewhere in there, but not quite the same thing.
Well, now that you've grown up, what are you doing?
I sell electronic parts to Pete and Jerry and all those guys.
Oh, great.
You're getting back at them.
Parts to build all those gizwidges to get you guys out of your jams. That's
Give them a break in price.
They've
really done a heck of a job with this, and I just want to thank Pete and Jerry personally for putting all this together, for working their fannies off over at the ranch house last night to even get us on the air. It was really a difficult procedure, and we have a lot of other people to thank, like Bill Wells, Chris Schiebel, the PD of WDJX, and Bill Wells being the GM of the radio station,
and
a cast of thousands.
They're all a bunch of princes. They certainly are.
That's
great. They certainly are. Well, I got you. Pete said somewhere along the line, I think everybody took sick one evening, and he ended up covering at the transmitter when they still had tables over at the transmitter one night with all the Coca-Cola. Hi-Fi Club 45s. Have you still got a copy of that sitting around there somewhere?
Yes, Bob shaking his head. Yeah, that was Pete's first time on the radio, too.
if you've got a few minutes, squeeze a little bit out on the air.
We'll try to do that. Bob's looking for it right now.
Okay.
That's great. Yeah, yes, Pete's air check. Pete's missing air check is right here. We'll play that in a few minutes.
Okay.
That's great.
Y'all take care.
Thanks for calling,
man. Enjoy yourselves. It sounds like everybody's having a good time.
Well, you know, to be OFs, we're doing pretty good here.
Well, it sounds great on the air.
Thanks for calling.
Take care.
Hey, listen, here's something Alan's got in here. We're going to play a bit of this right now. Alan, this is a air check of you at KLO.
Is this side B of this thing? I think Bob said earlier it was. Have you already
gone
through?
No, this is side A.
This is side A. Okay, let's see what Alan's...
There's a cue sheet there someplace that tells what's on there.
There it is.
On the bottom there.
Where's the cue sheet?
Five.
On the bottom?
Right there.
Okay. We have. This is side A of this cassette. Alan Bryan, KLO Air Checks, 9 to 12 noon record show, January 20th, 1964.
Yeah.
Yeah, partner. Yeah, that's good.
Days ago.
This was shortly after Alan returned. Well, here, you read it. It's your gig.
Shortly after Alan returned from... Yeah, this was... I was in the Army in 62 and 63, and I got out of the Army in about... 7th or 8th of December in 63, and this was in January 20th of 64, so it was about a month after I got out of the Army.
All right, that's great, Alan. That's Alan Bright, and that was the 1964 and the High Fet Club.
That was, 64.
Instrument. What kind of talent did you get out there?
Well, we were talking about that while the tape was playing. It was... It was not what you call good top 40 programming.
But you were talking
about... It was pretty weird.
You were talking about Mitch getting beside himself.
Well, this Hi-Fi Club had been on for a number of years. I guess Paul Kelly had originated it probably, I don't know, 58, 59, something like that. When I came to the station, it was already on, and I started doing the Hi-Fi Club with Paul before I went in the Army. He did one night a week, and I did the other night, and then when I came back, we got back to splitting again. And Horace Roth, who we've talked about a couple of times, who was a salesman for the station for probably 42 years, I guess, was the world's greatest salesman of remotes and gimmicks. And his biggest account was Coca-Cola. And the Hi-Fi Club was a part of his sales campaign with them. He basically sold them on this concept, and they thought it was great. He thought it was great. And we did these dances at schools on Friday and Saturday night. Well, one year they decided that they were going to have a talent contest at each school. And at the end of the school year, the winners from each school would participate in the big, playoff at the end of the year.
Sure.
And have a winner for the entire season. And, with all due respect to the people who are on the show, some of them may be listening right now. Number one, the talent was... marginal. You're talking about sometimes a 13 or 14 year old who's never performed in public before, who's decided they're going to sing, Somewhere Over the Rainbow for the first time in public, and their sister is back in the background, playing accompaniment on a piano.
Yeah.
And it was a good thing for the audience, for the live audience, but for the radio audience, it wasn't that good. Well, this got started before Mitch actually came in as program director, and I think we've talked a little bit about the fact that he was into super tight production, everything heavily formatted, and not a hair of open space between anything on the air. I mean, it was absolutely wall-to-wall sound. And the first time he heard this, he just about went through the ceiling. I mean, it was like, what is that on my radio station? I don't believe this. We accidentally switched channels with somebody, And then he and Horace got into a big hassle over it because, this was Horace's sacred Coca-Cola account.
Yeah, when I was there, too, it was sacrosanct.
And eventually, Mitch sort of won out. I don't know if they quit doing the live remotes. I think they did, and did it live from a studio Hi-Fi Club, and may have done the dances, but they weren't on the air. But the dances, it wasn't too bad when you were just doing the Hi-Fi Club without the talent contest, because most of the time was taken up by music. You were playing records, and it was the same music that was on all the rest of the time. But in the middle of this, here came this 30-minute segment of good old-fashioned live, entertainment programming from your local high school.
Like 1948.
Okay. And it was, I remember several occasions that, some poor 13-year-old girl who'd been convinced by her friends that she really had talent would get out there in front of all of the people in her school and open her mouth to sing, and nothing would come out. I mean, it was just...
And she carried that
zilch
mark with her for the rest of her life.
Right.
Yeah.
That was the gig. It was funny.
Well, you got high schools involved in everything back then. One thing you did in the news department, you had sports correspondents, too.
Yeah, we did. We started that in the early 60s, I guess, 60, 61, because I was looking through some things that I haven't had letter of recommendation that Ken Roland wrote for me when I was in the Army, because I was going to look for part-time work while I was in the Army. And he mentioned the fact that I had organized this sports correspondent setup. But what we did basically is we had a student in each of the high schools that we recruited to report live on the air, or we taped it, but it was a voice report from the student of their football and basketball games. So for probably, I don't know when it finally, I think Mitch probably was involved in getting that off the air, too, that we still had the correspondence, but they just called in, we wrote down the scores, and told people what they were. Probably 6 or 7 years, I guess, of, student reporters. Some of them were like the younger brothers and sisters of, people who had started it back in the early 60s, and when they came to the high school, they took over for their brother and sister and what have you. So it was another one of those audience participation things.
Yeah, and jerk the high schools in, get them into what you were doing, and that was a name of the game.
Another really big thing that Mitch did was it was called a school spirit contest.
Yes.
And basically, it was... are we listening to me?
No, we're not. That's,
okay.
That's queuing
that's
up right
here.
Now.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was a petition-type thing. You know, the school that got the most signatures on a petition would receive a dance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the jocks from the station would come out to the school and do a free... hop, I guess we call them.
We started to do that at Lebanon Junction, too, and,
really?
And then we looked around and said, we got four students, this isn't going to
yeah.
work, you know. No, we had about...
But I have, I've got a picture out here that we were looking at earlier where I was sitting on top of the petitions that had been brought in that year from the school spirit contest. It was down in the basement of the station. It was a stack about, I want to say, 5 feet high of paper that had been brought in by these students. It was just hundreds of thousands of signatures on these things.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just one of those things that we, you know, we thought it was going to be kind of neat promo, and it just sort of got out of hand, and it was just, boom, went crazy. It
sort of got out of hand.
But, yeah, we did a lot of things like that to get people involved and,
yeah.
you know, be involved with the community.
That's great. But, you know, you look back on it now, the biggest thing was you had a good time doing it. It was a job, but you had a good time.
Yeah.
You know.
I think almost with, well... The main part that I didn't have a good time with in radio was getting up early in the morning when I worked with Bailey.
No way.
Yeah, because I had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning every day and be at the station at 5.
Yeah.
And once I got there and once we got cooking and things were moving along, it was fun. I enjoyed it. But every morning, you know, when I got up at 4 o'clock and thought, oh, I've got to go do that again.
I've always believed that I believe you should get up as the sun is going down. You know, that's,
was there a time when you heard the police radio and your car had gotten off the parking
lot? Yeah, I was talking about that yesterday. We were, you know, 3rd and Walnut, 307 West Walnut, and I parked at the parking lot of the Penn Dennis Club, which is at, I guess, 2nd and mm-hmm. Walnut, and they had a, you know, paid parking lot on the corner there, still do. And that's where I parked. And, of course, when I came to work at 5 o'clock in the morning, there was nobody in the parking lot, and there was nobody on the street. It was pretty deserted at that time. And, of course, in the newsroom, we monitored the police radios all the time for accidents and stuff that we wanted to follow up on as news stories. And I'm sitting there going through my usual morning routine of making calls, you know, checking on stuff and looking at the paper to see what was going on, getting tapes ready for the news and so forth. And... this call came across the police radio. They had to check on an abandoned car in the middle of the street at 2nd and Liberty, which kind of caught my attention, mainly because it was just a block away, you know, but that didn't occur to me at all that it might be my car. And a few minutes later, the guy calls back on the air and, you know, on the police radio to the dispatcher and says, yeah, there's a car here in the middle of the street. And, you know, we don't know how it got here. There's nobody around or anything else. And I'm thinking... my car is the only car that I can think of in Louisville that could be in the middle of that intersection right now, just sort of accidentally. So I jumped on the phone, called the dispatcher, and said, ask the guy what, you know, what kind of car that is. And I think it was a Ford Galaxy I had at the time or something. And so he gets on the radio and he comes back and says, oh, that's a maroon, all right, you know, Ford Galaxy, blah, blah, blah. And I said, That's mine. I'll be right there.
What would you...
So I ran down the street, parked my car back, set the emergency brake this time.
What year was your Ford Galaxy? 64 maroon Ford Galaxy. That's why.
Yeah, this was probably a 60, 65 maybe, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Great cars. Great times, too.
I made a big mistake of not putting air conditioning in the car, though.
Yeah, got that. Listen, I'm going to go over something while Alan here. Alan Bryan and Dick Braun, myself, Tad Murray, Bo Brady, back from the KLO days. By the way, this is...
and the great Pete Boyce.
Pete Boyce is here, too. The guy that's been engineering at KLO since, let's see, they went on in 48.
And then I went off and became self-employed building radio stations.
That's right. Bruce Clark, of course, was chief engineer for years and years and years. And Bruce has retired a couple years ago, right?
He retired, and he was the first mayor of Mount Washington, Kentucky.
The first mayor?
Yes, he was.
The original.
The original mayor of Mount Washington, Kentucky.
How old were you when you first...
I was 18.
18.
Yeah.
18 years old.
Yeah. Of course, I was really enamored by Paul Cowley and all these people who lived, you know, worked here in... and that's what got me here and start with.
Well, Alan, the Hi-Fi Club we heard a minute ago, you were sitting in for Paul that night,
right,
too, weren't you?
I think, Pete, that was when he had had the accident and had had surgery and was recuperating.
Right. Paul was home recovering from an accident, and that was when he and Jeanette did the Hi-Fi Club together from the bed at home.
Yeah, I think that was maybe a week or two later.
Wait a minute now. They did the hype from the what?
From home.
From home. They did
they
it from
did
home.
It from their house. Yeah.
Live from Paul Cowley's bedroom.
Live from Paul Cowley. I don't remember that. Live from Paul Cowley's bedroom. They did the high five.
That's true.
Well, yeah, nothing changes, does it? That's great.
Al, another side story that's kind of neat. You were talking about the Army a while ago.
Yeah.
And when Alan came home, I believe you came home to a reserve unit.
Yeah.
The 220th Public Information Detachment. And back in those days, it was commanded by a gentleman named Sam Allgood, who you may remember from WHAS.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, well, the 220th unit was a small unit. There was only 28 of us in that unit. And it was a radio station for the Army. And we were trained to go overseas and do broadcasts in the event of an emergency. And because of this, they sent us overseas on trips to train in the summertime.
Oh, no.
So for 2 weeks, we went to San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Oh.
Frankfurt, Germany.
What a shame.
Seoul, Korea. Sent us to Frankfurt, Alaska, and Fairbanks, Alaska. And we went to Washington, D.C., and we went out to Colorado a couple of times. Anyhow, this was kind of a fraternity of broadcasters because we had people from every station in town. And once a month, we got together for the weekend, and we all got to swap stories.
Yeah.
And we all knew each other from all the other stations. We got a chance to meet for a whole weekend together and talk stories. So everybody kind of thought, how do these guys know this about the other stations? Yeah. Well, we were there for a whole weekend together. We knew what was going on.
Plus, you were Army.
I was only a member of that unit for a short time because I was working, I forget what it was. I was working at night or something, and I got an exemption and got out of it. But the one year that I was there, we went to Fort Slocum, New York. And that was 1964, the year of the World's Fair.
Mm-hmm.
So we all got to go to the World's Fair on Uncle Sam. It was a lot of fun.
And
sounds like
Reed Yaden's a member of that fraternity.
Okay.
Yeah, he played Army with us. And also Mason Dixon played Army, believe it or not.
David was playing Army?
Yep, he sure did.
No, this is not.
David, the time warp, this can't be true.
Yes, that's right. You know, Mason, the first time I'd seen him in 5 years was last week, and, he's ridden a rough road for the last 6 years and been up North Carolina, and I said, David, you're alive! And he was in Army. No, he wasn't Army. He was in that bunch, too, huh?
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, it wasn't like real Army, though. I mean,
well, of course not.
This is a radio station, and we just kind of played and had a good time. But yeah. I wasn't actually in that unit very long, but it was, as Pete said, it was really interesting because it was it brought all these different people from different stations together, which was not very common for any other reason at that time. You didn't fraternize with the enemy, so to speak, and it was really fun. There was I was trying to think of who it was. There's a guy named Brad Broker that
Brad
was in that unit.
He's still here with the
Army. Yeah, he's the president of whatever it is that puts on these Broadway shows and stuff that come into Louisville. He was a member of that unit, and he's the only guy that I have seen occasionally from time to time that, we sort of remember that we were, in that unit together. But it was neat.
Hmm. That's a great, great story there. Here's something. Oh, by the way, this is WDJX AM, Louisville, Kentucky. And we're remembering 1080 with a reunion.
Not for much longer.
Not for much longer, no. I think it's Monday. I believe it's Monday that the frequency 1080 is being leased, being transferred to an organization that is going to program religious programming. And for the first time in since 1948, what we call contemporary music, either rock or country, will not be on 1080. So we just had a little reunion and cried at our beers. Good heavens.